Hello and welcome to this final part of a special three-part podcast series from Blackwell Online about one of the most successful medical books ever published, the Oxford Handbook of Clinical Medicine. These three podcasts provide an opportunity to meet the people behind the OHCM, whose names you may only have glanced at as you pick up your well-thumbed copy of the book. In Programme 1, we heard how the book came into existence and challenged the prevailing culture of medical education. And in the second programme, we explored the philosophy behind the book and what part the authors hope it plays in helping students become good doctors. In this final programme, we talk about the international appeal of the book, the challenge of keeping it up to date, and the handbook in an age in which the white coat has disappeared and tablet computers are rapidly replacing printed books. And at the end, I asked my guests what it has meant to them personally to be associated with this best-selling medical handbook. Joining me in this programme once again are handbook authors Tony Hope, Murray Longmore and Ian Wilkinson, as well as later in the programme, the handbook's editor at OUP, Liz Reeve. I began with a question from Murray. How do the authors make the book as useful as possible in an international context?
I think it's important for the book to be specific enough to go from the book to the bedside, obviously to check facts, especially when you're dealing with something that you're not familiar with. So it is based on our own practice where possible. Obviously, it may be quite different in another country where people may be a different weight range or have different genetic makeups and so on. I think that it's essential that the book is rooted in England but tries to be universal where possible. And I think it is a matter of judgment how much you can universalize some aspects of medicine.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Murray. I think some of the central tenets of medicine are translatable to most countries. I think coming back to this business of increasing evidence base, that does create a slight issue. But I think a lot of it is still applicable if you write it carefully. Certain countries will present a challenge. The USA, for example, I think it would be difficult because they're very protocol-driven. Protocols may be very different. But it doesn't mean that some of the advice in the book, common sense aspects of what's said, and the other background isn't applicable there as well.
The book has spawned a US edition, I understand, and it's also gone into translation in more than a dozen languages. So is each version being sort of sensitively adapted to local conditions?
No, in a word. The Spanish edition solemnly delights in explaining the difference in mental health law between England and Scotland, which must be of great interest to our Spanish readers.
But that's not true of all the editions. So the American edition has been Americanized, not just in the sort of names of drugs, but also to some extent in the attitudes about caring for patients. So there are changes there. But I think there's there would be a great danger in trying to write a book for the international market and erring on the side then of becoming vague. It's better, I think, to be absolutely precise about practice in the UK. And then I think people in other countries, they can always use the blank pages to write the differences, but at least they can see a practice that is recognised by a country that has a pretty good medical service.
What was the updating process like back in the early days? I imagine that's something that's changed, but do you remember how you set about, after the success of the first edition, preparing for the second?
When we were preparing the second edition, computers had become available in large institutions, and we thought that that might be a good way to go forward. We decided not to. And we had quite an extensive meeting with OUP. Then we just had that meeting when the Amstrad PCW came out, which was an early and cheap computer. And then we just decided to reverse that decision immediately and to go with that. And that meant that we could get rid of the squared paper and change our minds as many times as we wanted to. And we produced the first book that OUP set from disk, and we were able to refine what we were saying over many iterations. And it was quite frustrating, but also very satisfying when we got a page to work and we were able to say everything that we wanted to say. We would come to what looked like a full and difficult page with new ideas that we wanted to put in. We'd think this is impossible, but then by a process of refining, we would get the new material in and we would be able to have a sort of condensation without any elimination.
I'm interested in how you manage the creep to write on the blank pages. Because if you look at going from one with all blank pages virtually to five or eight, it is a lot of space removed as blank space and actually filled up with information.
We found when the third edition was coming into being that guidelines were coming to be produced, and we felt that we needed to address these, and we also wanted to make the third edition different from the previous two, which is something that marketing is always keen for. And so I produced these boxes and asked OUP what they thought. This was for a reprint, and they said, oh no, you can't possibly do that. It's much too good an idea. You've got to keep that for the next edition. So we did that, and then in the fourth edition, those boxes became a distinguishing factor of that edition.
On that, I remember, I think there were two things that sort of persuaded me onto the top of the slippery slope. I don't know that I wanted to slide down quite as far. I mean, one thing was, with each edition, we had two new junior doctors to maintain that junior perspective. And they would come with wanting more and more information. And so there was always a bit of a fight, I think, with Murray and me on one side and the new authors on the other, with Murray and me trying to keep the information restricted to one page and the enthusiastic new young authors wanting extra. So there was always that strong pressure. And then rather informal market research suggested that people weren't using the blank pages to the extent that Murray and I had imagined they were, and that Murray and I felt we would have used the blank pages. And so actually the blank pages remained pretty well blank in most people's pockets. So it was a very easy solution then to how do you get the extra information. But our rule, certainly as it sort of went from second to third and third to fourth edition, was pretty well that only diagrams and tables should be on the blank page, not the text shouldn't spill over. We thought that was going too far in going down the slippery slope.
We've got copies of all the editions on the table in front of us, and one of them bears the amazing line, updates by fax. Tell me a bit about what was going on then.
Well, this was in the early 90s, before the internet was available. We wanted to offer a solution to the problem of how to keep up to date, which is one that authors feel strongly about, and perhaps to a less extent, practicing doctors. I think it can be destabilizing for doctors to realize that their knowledge is partial and that it needs updating. The idea of the updates by fax, and also a second idea, which was to have update boxes printed in the BMJ, was to enable that task to be as painless as possible for the doctor to do. The BMJ boxes came with a sort of dotted line and a pair of scissors so you could cut it down to size and it fitted exactly onto the right-hand page. And you could also subscribe to a fax service. Really, this idea needed the internet to take off before it was a coherent idea. And in the fourth and fifth edition, Oxford Clinical Mentor was created as a spin-off of the book, which was updated every fortnight. And that downloaded software automatically overnight onto your system. So it was the forerunner of that. But we realized that what people really want is a well-written book, and that the problems of updating a book continuously dilute that energy that you have for writing clear and definitive text. And in the end, we decided that that was more important and that that's what we should concentrate on, and have regular new editions, but between editions, not to have much in the way of updates except for essential things like cardiopulmonary resuscitation and that sort of thing.
So now that we've left the age of the fax and the Amstrad behind, what kind of program of revisions do you take part in? What's actually involved in keeping this book up to date?
Well, I subscribe for many years to The Lancet, the New England Journal, and the BMJ, and an Infectious Diseases Journal. So I would be scanning those for good trials, and particularly I would concentrate on the introduction to good articles, where authors would explain the context of a disease and where the disease was going and what the main growing points were, and I begin to communicate those. Maybe the result of the trial was equivocal, but still the introduction or the conclusions would be very interesting to read. And so they would feed in. We've always had the book very well referenced for that reason, partly to give it authority and partly to bring to the reader's attention the controversial and growing areas so that the reader feels they're part of an evolving system of knowledge, not something which is handed down ready-made.
It is difficult. It gets more and more challenging each edition because the volume of publications is exponentially rising. It's made somewhat easier by organisations like NICE, which sift through them and do an evidence synthesis. And I guess I'm slightly more pragmatic in I like to see how new trials play out in the real world before rushing into rewriting a section and changing how we suggest medicine's practiced. I think it is important to let new ideas bed down. They're often wrong, and it's only with the passage of time that you realise that. Equally, it is interesting how in looking back through the first edition, some things which were dogmatically recommended then, we now know are wrong. And medicine's continually evolving in that way.
And certainly by the fourth edition, between the third and the fourth, really, edition, it was no longer just an issue of writing the next edition. It was really a cottage industry by then, in which Murray and I were working every week on trying to get the updates between the editions. And that's what in the end left me, I worked on the book in the first four editions and then left, because by then it had become almost 2 days a week work just to keep the book updated, and I had other things that I also wanted to do. And so then Ian brilliantly came in and as co-author.
With a team of authors, there are sometimes differences of opinion. Is there a way that you can resolve a disagreement if it arises between you over something that one of you thinks should go in and another thinks perhaps should wait?
Yes. Obviously, we do have disagreements. Each author is responsible for their own chapters, so they will have the final say on what goes in. But we certainly are up for influencing each other, and very often through dialogue, you can get the best resolution. You may think you're coming from a diametrically opposed direction, but in fact, it's very easy usually to find some common ground or to put an alternative in. But we don't want two opinions to stand side by side. It's very important to be coherent. And so that's why each individual author, including the junior authors, has the final say on how their chapter looks.
Yeah, I mean, it's rare for us to disagree emphatically about something. And usually, as Murray said, it's a matter of just having a brief discussion about something and then leaving it to the discretion of who owns, in inverted commas, that chapter or who's taken responsibility for that chapter.
One of the things that I really enjoyed about writing the book and working on it with Murray was that we almost encouraged disagreement amongst ourselves. So we wouldn't... I mean, the final solution is that one section is somebody's responsibility and they make the final decision. But one of the joys was to be quite critical of the other person's text. And then Murray and I would often have quite animated discussions about issues. But that was part of the fun. I mean, in the end, meeting over a cup of coffee, if you've got the right sort of friendship and relationship, you'll solve the disagreements that way in the end. But I wouldn't want to underplay the value of disagreements in helping to produce the book.
What about the role of feedback from users of the book? Is that something which has been there right from the start?
We had the readers' comments cards, I think, from the second edition only. They have proved a source of inspiration, really. They've arrived from around the world in large numbers, explaining to us that the medicine that we promulgate is not so simple or straightforward, and indeed providing solutions to problems that we have. The causes of pancreatitis, for example, produced a mnemonic in which there was no cause beginning with S, and we were immediately contacted by somebody from Trinidad to say scorpion bites can be a potent cause of pancreatitis, and so our problem was therefore solved. And it's a source of inspiration to have had the feedback, because people have written about how appreciative they have been of what we've written. And I think OUP, can we move to Liz? I think you've got some examples of feedback.
We had a birthday party for the Oxford Handbook of Clinical Medicine when it reached its 21st birthday. And we had a birthday party at Foyles, and we invited readers of the book to send in their comments, and we received so many poems and songs about the book, and, you know, really showing the love that the junior doctors and medical students have internationally for the book. You know, it's really is an international, worldwide friend in the pocket, as I think Murray or Tony said earlier.
I mean, at some stage in its life, it became known by the nickname Cheese and Onion. Does anybody know when that occurred? Because I think that's a real sign of affection, isn't it? It's no longer known by its author's names or its given name, but it's known by a nickname.
Tony never knew whether it was I that was the cheese or he was the onion.
You were the big cheese.
I don't know the answer to that question, but I do know that it has a Facebook page about cheese and onioning, which is the most interesting or extreme pace you've been photographed with the book.
Well, that's really an invitation for me to ask for some examples that you may have seen on this Facebook page.
Jungle, skiing, whitewater rafting, could go on and on.
Murray spoke earlier about how putting out updates all the time might possibly militate against thinking about how the book was written. Now, we're in a very electronic age, and so I wondered how the book is adapting to that age.
We want our readers to love the book for its feel and what it gives them, and we've been very lucky that OUP have supported us in making the book as beautiful as it can possibly be, and we are enhancing that, I hope, with each edition. And the electronic side of things very much puts us on our mettle. We've got to show that a book is a beautiful thing as well as an instructive thing. We are developing that. We're making the typography as good as we can, the outlay to be as easy on the eye as possible. And that's something that an electronic version can't compete with, we believe. And so we are confident that the book will have a long and happy life in its physical form. And we are happy to work in the electronic side. The beauty and the usability of the book and a product that you can hold in your hand is something that we will always be sort of capitalizing on.
I think it brings a challenge. I agree with Murray. I mean, holding something in your hand in the printed form, it is difficult to replace. And, you know, it's not just this book, but book sales hold up because of that. We, you know, 10 years ago, we thought they'd disappear from the bookshops. It would all be downloads. I think it does present a challenge, and I think we do have electronic forms of the book currently. They don't sell as well or are widely used as the paper version. But I'm interested in seeing how that develops and how we might produce an electronic version which is usable, more readily available to junior doctors. Tony talked about fitting in your white coat pocket. Well, you know, the government's banned me from wearing my white coat. So particularly as a male without a handbag on the ward, it is a challenge as to where you put a book. And therefore, having it available on a phone or a tablet, I can see the sense in that. I don't think it's as pleasurable to use, but I do think we need to cater for that. And I think it's a process of evolution, and we will eventually move, presumably, to selling more copies that way than the printed version.
So from a publisher's point of view, how do you sort of see the landscape of the electronic and the paper editions?
Well, we have Clinical Medicine on Oxford Medicine Online, which is our online medical platform, and we have all the Oxford handbooks, which obviously Clinical Medicine is the central title of the series. All the other 60 are on there, as well as the related series, such as the Oxford Desk References and so on. We also have the app version for the handheld, which can be downloaded to your phone, as Ian mentioned. And I think for our thinking from OUP, junior doctors use the different forms in different ways than medical students. So sitting at home, they might want to look at the online version. Sitting on the train, they would want maybe want the print or the app version. On the wards, they'd probably want the electronic version. Or some people still would prefer the print, I think. And I think we just need to have to move with the times, but take, there's different forms to suit different people and different kinds of doctors, really. I don't think there's a solution that one format fits all, really.
Maybe I can ask you all in conclusion what being involved with this book has meant to you personally and to your careers.
Well, I would consider it one of the things I'm proudest of. I think in my career, even though most of my career has been in medical ethics and quite outside this field, but I feel being involved with this book is one of the achievements I am proudest of. It's had quite a big effect on my on some of the side issues in my life, not so much my central work in medical ethics, but I think I would not have become a delegate of Oxford University Press had it not been that I have been co-author of this book, and that was a great source of interest and pleasure to me. And I think it did have an effect, I think, in me. I was started a course in medical ethics in the medical school in Oxford at a time when medical ethics was rather looked down on. And I think it gave me street credibility with the medical students that I was the co-author of this book. I think they wouldn't have taken somebody coming in and teaching medical ethics as seriously had I not had that street credibility. So I think it did have a very beneficial effect to me in that.
Well, the Oxford handbooks have been weaving in and out of my professional life now for 30 years. And this ninth edition coming up of OHCM will be my last. So I can see how the handbook has influenced my practice. And I think the easiest way of answering the question is that it's enabled me to make sense of my clinical practice. I see something interesting with my patients, I talk to them about it, and then I can feed that into the book, and then the book feeds back into my patients. And that's one of the most satisfying circularities, to have been able to cure somebody thanks to what I was reading for the book, and then for somebody else to be able to cure somebody else thanks to a patient that I've been treating.
I think I was very flattered to be given the opportunity to work on a established book that was so widely used, and it's helped me learn to write scientifically and edit, and I think they're invaluable skills I use every day of my life. Also, it's given me an opportunity to influence how my students and my colleagues learn medicine and ultimately practice medicine. But the converse of that is it's a good resource for keeping me aware of changing practice in medicine and fields I don't work in.
I was talking to Murray Longmore, Ian Wilkinson, Tony Hope and Liz Reeve about the Oxford Handbook of Clinical Medicine. To find out more and to order the book, go to blackwell.co.uk. This was the final programme in this special series of podcasts sponsored by Blackwell Online. I hope you've enjoyed the glimpse behind the scenes of a medical bestseller. All that remains for me to say is thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.